Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 11, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will explore the use of cost-benefit analysis in the courts. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Emily Hammond, Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School, and Eugene Scalia, partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. After Professor Hammond's opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Emily. The floor is yours.
All right. Thank you very much, Laura, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this discussion. I'll begin my comments with some framing along administrative law principles, and you'll see this tries to be descriptive, but there are certainly some normative components as well. I see two major questions surrounding the topic of benefit cost analysis and the courts. The first one is whether it's required, whether benefit cost analysis is required. If so, how is it to be done? And second, whether there is a role for judicial review, and if so, what should the standard be? The answer to the first question is really a matter of statute and executive order. Everyone listening is likely familiar with Executive Order 12866 and its progeny, which mandates cost-benefit analysis for executive agencies' major rules meeting certain specified criteria. Now, that analysis is not always required, and there is no cause of action to directly enforce the requirements. So that takes us to statutes, and the judicially enforceable mandates are those arising from statutes. Here, of course, we have two categories of statute: agencies' statutory mandates, and then generally applicable statutes like the APA. As a matter of statutory law, here's what we have at a bird's eye view. First of all, we know that Congress can forbid cost considerations. So, for example, in Whitman versus American Trucking, the Supreme Court held that language in the Clean Air Act regarding criteria pollutants forbids EPA from considering cost when setting ambient air quality standards, even though costs are required to be considered later down the line when states determine how to meet those standards. We also know from the case Entergy versus Riverkeeper that when a statute is silent as to cost, agencies generally have discretion to consider costs, providing that doing so is reasonable within the language of the statute. So in this particular case, the court held that a provision of the Clean Water Act concerning technology-based standards for cooling water intake structures at power plants, although silent about cost, does permit the EPA to consider costs when setting standards. Now, when we turn to the 2015 case, Michigan versus EPA, there the question was whether an agency has discretion to refuse to consider costs in the face of the following statutory language, again from the Clean Air Act. And the particular provision at issue specifies that EPA should regulate toxic air emissions from power plants if it determines that doing so is, quote, appropriate and necessary, end quote. So in the Supreme Court's decision, the majority of the court stated that the term appropriate and necessary does consider at least some attention to cost. The court further stated that no regulation is appropriate if it does more harm than good. And finally, the court said that reasonable regulation ordinarily requires paying attention to the advantages and the disadvantages of regulation. The dissenting justices disagreed about the record and the ordering of the steps that EPA must take, but they did agree with the majority's view that regulation would be unreasonable if the agency gave no thought to cost at all. Now, what happened on remand after this? I think it's interesting. Here, EPA quickly readopted the prior rule, so it did continue on the course of regulating air toxics. But this time, it based its rule not just on its prior record, but also on all of the additional cost analysis that it had done at later stages of the original rulemaking, including its analysis for OIRA. So currently, its methods for doing that cost-benefit analysis are subject to a lawsuit that has now been held in abeyance while the Trump administration reviews the rule. But it does raise the question of how cost-benefit analysis should be done and what that Michigan case tells us about that particular question. I contend that it overreads both the majority and the dissent in Michigan to conclude that agencies now must always conduct a formal quantitative benefit cost analysis of the type expected for OIRA review to meet the reasonableness standard. And if you look carefully at the majority opinion in Michigan, it confined its language there. The court emphasized that it was not telling EPA how to do its analysis, and in particular, the court was not willing to state that EPA must monetize all costs and benefits. The relevant quote here is, "It will be up to the agency to decide, as always, within the limits of reasonable interpretation, how to account for cost." So there you can see just from this quote, again, the emphasis on the organic statutory language as always being the starting point for determining whether costs are to be considered and what factors must be considered. Let me turn also to the APA, getting away from those precise statutory mandates. When courts are reviewing agencies under the APA, the touchstone of all of the standards of review that are relevant here is reasonableness, whether we're talking about an agency interpreting its statutory language or a general policy justification. Michigan tells us that it's unreasonable not to balance the pros and cons of regulating, but that seems to be a fairly unremarkable proposition. Particularly if one believes that a core component of administrative legitimacy is rationality rather than arbitrariness. Now, the scope of those pros and cons is going to be determined by the statutory mandate, not the EPA. In a moment, I believe Jean will discuss the role of public comment in this regard in creating an analytical obligation. But here I'd like to emphasize that that obligation is always limited by the scope of the statute. So how about that second question I started with? How about the role of judicial review more generally? First of all, I think that a tendency when we're talking about these types of things is to forget that judicial review is not the end-all be-all of what happens in administrative agencies or in developing administrative law. Compliance with 12866 is not reviewable. If one is using the APA or statutory mandate for a cause of action, one must meet their criteria, including limitations on reviewability, like finality. And of course, there are judicial doctrines limiting reviewability. But let's say we get to judicial review. It would be a vast overstepping of judicial authority to require monetized cost-benefit analysis in all cases. And I think the majority in Michigan was correct in recognizing that very point. And I think it might be helpful to take a step back for a moment to a different context for some helpful insights about this, and that's rate making. Agencies, federal agencies at least, don't do a whole lot of that anymore. But at the decades and leading up and through the APA and its passage, rate making was the bread and butter work of many federal agencies. In the early 1900s, there were debates brewing about the role of the courts in reviewing how agencies set rates. And particularly, there were debates about the appropriate ways to value the capital of regulated companies. The question was, must courts require some methodology? Perhaps does the Constitution even require some methodology? And in a 1944 case called Federal Power Commission versus Hope Natural Gas, the Supreme Court officially got courts out of the business of specifying and mandating deep methodological details. The reasoning here is probably familiar to our listeners. Congress entrusted the agency with administering the statute, not the courts. The agency has the expertise, not the courts. And indeed, courts are not equipped to act as economists. This principle is very deeply rooted, and I think it's continuous through today. And it really leads to a summary of the points I've made and those that I hope to have discussion about as we continue. First, the idea that the statute sets the parameters when we're talking about benefit-cost analysis. Second, it's generally unremarkable to expect agencies to determine that there is more good than harm when they decide to regulate. But finally, that it would be wrong to expect courts to mandate particular methods of cost-benefit analysis in the absence of express statutory language. So with that, I'll conclude my opening remarks and look forward to hearing from Gene.
Emily, thanks. That was a great introduction and overview. What I'd like to do is offer, a series of four propositions, some very related to the topics that Emily was talking about, and some that extend beyond that. Let me start with the observation that cost-benefit analysis of one form or another is, in my judgment, an integral part of agency rulemaking. And how an agency discharges that function is properly subject to judicial review. And I think that Emily and I are on the same page on that by and large. The Michigan v. EPA case really, I think, at this point is the key case on that issue. And just to read a couple of excerpts, first from the majority opinion by Justice Scalia, quote, "One would not say that it is even rational, never mind appropriate, to impose billions of dollars in economic costs in return for a few dollars in health or environmental benefits. Consideration of cost reflects the understanding that reasonable regulation ordinarily requires paying attention to the advantages and the disadvantages of agency decisions." That's the majority opinion. And then, as Emily noted, the dissent was on this particular point very much on the same page, quote, "Cost is almost always a relevant and usually a highly important factor in regulation. Unless Congress provides otherwise, an agency acts unreasonably in establishing a standard-setting process that ignores economic considerations." End quote, and that was Justice Kagan in dissent. And Emily used the word unremarkable, and I agree that in a sense it really is unremarkable that costs and benefits ought to be considered in ordinary APA rulemaking, unless somehow barred by statute. As Justice Scalia's majority opinion suggested, cost and benefits in a way are just another way of talking about advantages or disadvantages, pros or cons. A rule is always adopted for its purported benefits, and so there will be a discussion of benefits, and naturally that discussion should include as well possible drawbacks that result from the regulatory action. That's all in the mix of what one would expect to be discussed. And to the extent that those benefits and costs are quantifiable pros and cons, certainly it's appropriate as well that that be part of the discussion. Put differently, it's not simply an outgrowth of the normal APA rulemaking process. It's also part of the State Farm decision, which says that you have to consider important aspects of the problem. An important aspect of the problem is whether a rule will have great costs and whether those costs indeed might be far greater than the benefit that's anticipated from the regulatory action. The second proposition that I want to offer is that rulemaking comments have a significant impact on the depth and rigor of a cost-benefit analysis that an agency must perform. There is a lot of academic commentary in this area, but relatively little of that commentary focuses on the significance of what the rulemaking commenters have done in driving what the agency does with regard to cost-benefit analysis. You know, as I noted under the Supreme Court's seminal State Farm decision regarding arbitrary and capricious review, we know that one thing an agency can't do is ignore important aspects of the problem. We also know, and this is just black-letter APA stuff, that they have to take account of significant comments that are in the rulemaking record, at minimum respond and explain why they're not making a change, or alternatively, adapt the rule in light of those comments. What that means, then, is if I put in a comment that, for example, has a rigorous quantitative cost-benefit analysis, under most statutes, the agency is not going to be able to brush that aside. It needs to take account of it. It needs to respond to it. And so put differently, if you look at the Michigan EPA case, it might have been a different case had the EPA itself not actually had some cost data, which it put forward and said, these costs are huge. In that case, that data, I think, came from the agency, but it certainly many times it comes from or could come from commenters. When commenters do so, they can force the agency to raise its own game. And as I'll explain in a moment, I think that can improve the rulemaking process as a whole. Third proposition, the D.C. Circuit has been rightly critical of the cost-benefit analysis in a number of rules adopted by financial regulatory agencies, particularly the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's been a lot of academic commentary on a line of D.C. Circuit decisions that includes a case known as Business Roundtable, but includes about four or five other cases challenging SEC rules. I was involved in a number of those cases. The academic commentary has been fairly critical of the court's decision, but I think it's mistaken. And I say that in part because of the familiarity I do have with the rulemaking record in those cases. So I'll give you a couple examples. The first in this line of cases was Chamber of Commerce versus the SEC, the so-called mutual fund governance case. In that case, there was an economic study submitted by a commenter, but the chairman of the SEC gave it the back of his hand and really paid it no attention at all. And the reason he gave is fascinating, especially because the SEC was under a statutory duty to consider its rules' effects on efficiency, competition, and capital formation. And what the chairman said, and by the way, he was a Republican-appointed chairman, was he wasn't really going to give this study any weight because he said, there are no empirical studies that are worth much. You can pretty much do anything you want with the numbers. Now, that's a paraphrase, but close to a direct quote of the reason he gave. You know, empirical studies aren't worth much. Well, you know, that was plainly wrong. And the agency did have an obligation to give attention to that study. The Business Roundtable case is heavily criticized by some academic commenters for the cost-benefit analysis the court conducted, or rather the analysis it conducted of the SEC's cost-benefit analysis. But again, the SEC made some very conspicuous errors. For example, in addressing the costs of its the regulatory change at issue, it argued that it would not be implicated very frequently, that this mechanism wouldn't be used often. When it came to the benefit discussion, it didn't about face and hypothesized it would be used thousands of times. That was obviously very internally inconsistent. Or another example, it was explained to the SEC that labor unions and state pension funds would be the principal users of this new proxy access mechanism that was being adopted by the SEC, and it was explained that they would abuse the mechanism to the detriment of most shareholders. The SEC just ignored that significant disadvantage, that significant cost of the rule. So the Business Roundtable case concerned some very rudimentary rulemaking blunders by the SEC, and it was quite reasonable of the D.C. Circuit to throw that rule out as it did. There's a lot of discussion in the academic commentary about how difficult cost-benefit analysis can be, particularly in the financial sector. I don't buy it, but the principal point I want to make is that even supposing there's a point at which it becomes extremely difficult to do a credible cost-benefit analysis of financial sector regulation, we haven't gotten anywhere near that yet. The blunders, the shortcomings that have resulted in a number of financial rules to be invalidated to date have been rudimentary blunders, really of a Michigan v. EPA type variety, and we haven't gotten close to testing the limits of agencies' ability to reliably engage in cost-benefit analysis in the financial sector. Fourth proposition, and this is one where I think Emily and I may have some disagreement, a quantified cost-benefit justification is superior in most instances to the alternative. Now, Emily read the caveat from Michigan v. EPA, which in full says that the court is not saying that the EPA was required to do a, quote, formal cost-benefit analysis in which each advantage and disadvantages is assigned a monetary value, end quote. That's from the majority opinion. They did stop short of that there. And I also want to emphasize that the problem to date, for example, with the financial sector regulation has not been a deficiency in the a quantitative cost-benefit justification. That is not why the SEC's rules, for example, have been invalidated. Instead, it's been a garden variety APA violation along the shortcoming that was identified in Michigan v. EPA. But having said that, in circumstances where it is possible to engage in a quantified cost-benefit justification, that is, to actually quantify costs and benefits and then to make some, you know, serious comparison of them, that beats the alternatives. And that is the final reason I would give for liking cost-benefit analysis. What else are you going to do? The SEC now at least purports to use cost-benefit analysis much more in its rulemaking than it used to. And that's for the good in part because it's talking about matters where it is engaged with more substance, more rigor than before. Often, if you don't have cost-benefit analysis, what you get instead is the agency's ipsy-dixit. You get speculation. You get sloganeering by the agency about the benefits. What cost-benefit analysis has the capability to do is to elevate the discussion by getting more specific about the good things that are associated with the rule and also more specific about the harm. So cost-benefit analysis, I think at the end of the day, has the potential simply to elevate the rigor and the intelligence of decision-making that's made by agencies. So let me stop there. Emily, I don't know if you want to take issue with anything I've had to say or Laura, whether you want to turn it over for questions, but I'll toss it back to you all.
I have a few comments, and maybe that can give our listeners some time to formulate their questions. So first of all, I think we do actually agree about many of the points that we've discussed. And I do want to highlight an appreciation of how you pointed out that a deep knowledge of the record is important for illuminating some of these judicial opinions. If you look at the Michigan versus EPA record, for example, it's almost bizarre to see how assiduously EPA avoids discussing cost when it has plenty of cost data in front of it. And it's constant denial of any consideration of costs. I don't know, maybe it was designed to create this test case, but I think it made it very easy for the court to remand that issue and say, my goodness, EPA, you have to do better than that. So your point there, I think, is very, very well taken. And I think it also is important for anticipating lawsuits that will arise out of Trump's deregulatory actions. We can expect challengers of those actions to take exactly the kind of approach you're discussing, which is providing robust comments during that period and really triggering the agency's obligation to explain why given data, given analyses are insufficient to change the agency's course of action. Let me also say, regarding your point about quantified cost-benefit analysis being superior to other methods, I don't think we disagree sort of in a general way about that point. What we might disagree about is the distinction between what the standard of review should be and what is good policy. Yes, it's true. We could probably debate all day if we were economists, which I'm not, about the best methods to use in valuing things and how to deal with the immeasurables that we have out there, like human dignity or a general preservation of the environment. But I think it's important if we're looking at judicial review that agencies are not required to do the very best. They are required to be reasonable. And so that's where I think we ought not expect the courts to be in the business of deciding what is the very best, provided the agency explained why it took a reasonable course of action given the statutory factors and given the record before it. So I wanted to maybe just add that nuance, at least to my own perspective, in response to your comments.
Right, and let me respond to that, because I do think that's an important point, the latter one. That, again, is, I think, where commenters can play a very important role, because although the agency does not need to display perfection in everything it does, it's seldom available to the agency to prefer what's mediocre to what's good, or what's good to what's better. So if the agency's position is this is this rule is a preferable policy move because it will have an incremental benefit, but I come in and show, you know, that incremental benefit is $10,000, and the cost is $20,000. The agency is no longer able to rest on its claim of an incremental benefit because there's better evidence of what that benefit is. So to the degree that participants in rulemaking or the agency itself is able to come forward with improved, more rigorous, nuanced assessments of what a rule will do, that forces everybody to raise their game. And although a court can't impose a quantified cost-benefit analysis on an agency, if the agency has been presented with one, it can't, I think, rationally prefer speculation or vague generalities to a concrete demonstration of a proposition. Now, it may have reasons to question the reliability of a quantitative cost-benefit analysis that was given to it. Or in some circumstances, it may say there are other important statutory factors that aren't captured by that analysis. But once a commenter has come forward with powerful, rigorous economic evidence, it's, I think, more often than not going to be available to the agency to just look the other way.
I think we agree on that point. Should we hear about questions?
Sure, let's go to audience questions.
In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing a first question, I'll ask one of my own. Could you talk a little bit about the two-for-one executive order and what it would mean for agency considerations of costs and benefits? Either of you?
I'll take a sort of initial observation. I think it's a fascinating change by the president. I think it's one of the potentially one of the most important changes in agency rulemaking in decades. And I think as a policy matter, it's insightful for a couple of reasons. I think first, I think you can make a good case that our government's big enough, and why don't we now, as we look for new areas to regulate, find ways to cut back as well. As a policy matter, I think that's a sensible way of looking at where we are now with the size of the federal government, the burden it places, and the like. Second, I do think that it will force a more thorough consideration within agencies of all the different things they're doing. And agencies that have good things that they want to regulate will now feel an obligation to go back and look at tired old rules that agencies, ordinarily just don't really want to bother with. So I think it's going to force a more careful evaluation by agencies of the sort of total burden that they impose on entities that they regulate. No doubt it will present challenges to them at certain times, but I think I like where it places the incentives.
And here's a point where I think we do disagree, at least in my thinking, in terms of how we might expect to see this unfold. So I think it's one thing to have a policy of wanting to reduce the regulatory burden on the regulated community. That's a perfectly legitimate policy. But my concerns about the executive order involve how on earth agencies will implement it. When we talk about agencies complying with the kinds of obligations, Gene, that you just described, the executive order, for example, focuses only on costs. It doesn't, at least on its face, or even if you look at the interpretive memo that came out from OMB, it doesn't appear to permit consideration of benefits. I would argue that just as ignoring cost might make an agency action unreasonable, ignoring benefits would do the same thing. And so I think it puts agencies in a bind if they're looking at a very beneficial regulation, for example, that they want to move forward with, but can only compare the cost of that regulation against the costs of existing regulations, particularly when, according to the interpretive memo from the OMB, sunk costs of compliance for regulations that are on the books cannot be counted. So it does create a ratchet in a deregulatory direction, but it does so in a way that may not be rational. Even from the most basic standards of considering the pros and cons of regulating. And so I do think that as we watch agencies grapple with how to implement the order in the context of specific rulemakings, this will be a significant challenge. I predict that much of the litigation will argue that agencies are going outside of the terms of their statutory mandates by considering or by relying on this executive order rather than grounding their analyses in requirements that are within the statutes, which of course trump executive orders.
Let's go to our first audience question.
First, let me apologize. I missed the first part of your presentation, and I may not ask this question very artfully, and if so, I apologize. But I seem to recall from Professor Sunstein and Justice Breyer's textbook on administrative law that there was a cost-benefit analysis that assigned a cost to human life. Is that still in existence in the area of administrative law, or is that passed out of favor now? Can you discuss
Absolutely.
That?
It is still in existence, and people are always working, economists primarily are always working to develop better methods to make that accounting. But indeed, that is a ubiquitous measure when we're looking at benefits.
Yeah, that's correct, although it's not an issue that's presented in the area of financial sector regulation, which is one of the reasons why I and at least some academic commenters are puzzled by the claim that cost-benefit analysis does not have a proper place in financial regulation. My view is if you're regulating money, you ought to take account of money. And if you're adopting a rule because of its perceived benefits in economic terms, you should look carefully and not claim you're incapable of calculating the costs that it has in economic terms as well. So, yes, their cost-benefit analysis can become trickier and maybe a bit more subjective when you're weighing dollars against life or health. Fortunately, in the financial regulatory area, you don't even have that dilemma. And yet right now, it may be that area where there's the most academic pushback to cost-benefit analysis.
Seems to me, if I recall correctly, that there was a justice who argued that under the Clean Air Act, there was no provision for incorporating cost-benefit analyses in producing clean air. I think his name might have been Scalia. Am I misremembering that?
That's true. That's the Whitman American Trucking decision in which, indeed, Justice Scalia authored the opinion of the court determining, and I think it is important to recognize the narrowness of that opinion. It was grounded in very specific language of the Clean Air Act, pursuant to which EPA sets air quality standards for certain pollutants. There are six of them, criteria pollutants. And what's notable there is EPA is setting the standard for protection of human health, but once we get into the nitty-gritty of how states are to regulate to meet those standards, cost is considered. So I do think it's important to emphasize the narrowness of that particular opinion, and indeed, in the Michigan case, Justice Scalia once again distinguished that particular language from the language at issue in the Michigan case.
Yeah, and in case we need a reminder, the court's job is to interpret statutes, and that's what Justice Scalia was doing in Whitman. And the statute there was different, at least the provision and issue, than in Michigan v. EPA. He was not purporting to interpret the Constitution or the APA.
All right, thanks very much.
Let's go to our next audience question.
This is kind of a two-part question. Just given the executive order, and it seems that it may be more of a burden on the agencies to come up with a cost analysis, do you think that there is, I guess, a danger or possibility that the agencies, in order to kind of circumvent that, may start enforcing certain policies through private settlement agreements or enforcement actions, or by filing statements of interest in litigation when they're trying to push through a certain policy, but they haven't actually adopted a regulation on that policy? And I guess the second part is, have you seen that happen in the past, and would that be considered a final agency action where the DOJ is trying to, again, push forth an agenda or a certain policy through either enforcement, settlement agreements, enforcement actions, or statements of interest when they actually don't have a specific regulation on the topic?
So my view is that agencies do that all the time, no matter who is the president, as a means to develop their policy. I think a certain amount of that is perfectly reasonable in the sense that agencies get experience from particularly their enforcement activities that can help inform rulemakings ultimately. Of course, the counter argument and the concern is transparency, not just transparency, but undercutting that public participation process that Jean has emphasized is so important. And of course, avoiding judicial review. And I think, finality probably isn't even a question that would be reached when we're talking about enforcement activities, because those are virtually per se unreviewable. But if we're getting to the other reviewability requirements, then finality can be a problem. And so, yes, that is a danger, although I think it's something that our system is designed to tolerate to a certain degree.
Yeah, I agree with most of that. I think that whenever you require more of an agency engaged in rulemaking, you incentivize the agency to find alternative means of achieving its objectives. And those means tend to include, at times, issuing guidance, characterizing rules as merely interpretive rules, or just trying to change the law through litigation. So while I do think it's important that the adoption of new substantive so-called legislative rules be subject to a demanding process, when that's done by an administration, it's important that they be attentive to other means by which the agency might try to push the law aggressively without the degree of oversight that the administration thinks appropriate. Sometimes you're going to have reviewable final agency action there, sometimes not. An amicus brief filed by an agency is not something you can file a lawsuit about. But even when courts can't supervise that kind of collateral regulation, certainly the agency heads or officials at OMB can do it themselves.
Thank you so much. That was really insightful.
I'll make another call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next caller, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Monday, August 14th at 12 noon. Let me go to the next caller.
Hi there. Thanks for the insightful analysis by you both. Is there anything currently percolating in the appellate courts that you think will reach the Supreme Court in the next term or two on this particular topic?
Well, I mean, I've got to mention my case, the MetLife case, which to me was a really good example of the agency being heedless about the potential impact on the regulated entity. MetLife was designated so-called too-big-to-fail financial institution by a Dodd-Frank created agency called the Financial Stability Oversight Council. And, you know, MetLife explained to FSOC that designation would be extraordinarily burdensome and make it uncompetitive to the point that MetLife said it might it was already beginning to evaluate breaking the company up if it was going to be designated. And remarkably to me, FSOC didn't care. They were indifferent to that and refused to consider the impact on MetLife of that designation. The district court invalidated the designation of MetLife, and one of the grounds was it was arbitrary and capricious and inconsistent with Michigan v. EPA for FSOC to simply ignore the impact. Now, the fate of that case is unclear. It's on appeal in the D.C. Circuit. FSOC did appeal. The state case is now being held in abeyance because President Trump has ordered the Treasury Department to conduct a thorough evaluation of the entire too-big-to-fail designation process. But certainly that's one case kicking around where, in my judgment, there was a really very serious failure on the part of the agency to consider simply the consequences, the impact of the action it was engaged in.
Yeah. The example I have, like Gene's, has been held in abeyance, you know, because we have a new administration that's changing its policies. But it is the Michigan case on remand when EPA decided to readopt the rule regulating air toxics from power plants. Its cost-benefit analysis included this concept of co-benefits. The idea that there would be benefits achieved by the air pollution control technology, not just for controlling air toxics, but also for controlling other pollutants that are harmful to human health and the environment. EPA included those benefits in justifying its rule, and the litigation challenges that methodology, which does raise the question of what does the statute allow in terms of the factors that EPA can consider. Again, it's been held in abeyance, and we may never get the answer to that question in this case. But I will say we don't have the litigation yet, but something that I think will be interesting to watch is what happens with the social cost of carbon as we presumably start to see EPA rolling back some of its regulations aimed at mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. Again, mostly this is Clean Air Act activity, but EPA certainly justified regulations under Obama using the social cost of carbon, and Trump has now mandated that the agencies no longer use that metric, but the courts have already upheld the metric as being reasonable. And so there's an interesting question about the extent to which agencies could now reverse course given the state of play leading up to this point.
Let me mention two other things to keep an eye on. One is there is a court challenge to the so-called two-for-one executive order. I have not read the briefs in that or the complaint or anything. but with that important caveat, I'm skeptical that claim is ripe. It seems to me that there's nothing for a court to review until a rule is adopted or withdrawn in reliance or application of the two-for-one order. Nonetheless, that's a case out there worth watching. And then, you know, second, something that's gotten some discussion is certainly some have observed that, you know, cost-benefit analysis is a, you know, two-way street. And if an agency engaged in regulation needs to do a better job considering costs and benefits, including potentially quantifying them. So the argument goes, the rules are no different when you're deregulating, when you're taking a rule off the books, or just adopting a rule that one way or another makes the environment less regulatory. And so I do think it's possible you'll see challenges to agency action based on cost-benefit analysis and based on quantification even, coming from the other direction. There was a little hint of that when the Labor Department extended, but only for a brief period of time, the compliance date for its new fiduciary rule. The department the analysis engaged in seemed concerned that there might be a challenge from the rule's supporters based in part on a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, I agree with those points. And just a little bit more on that two-for-one litigation. I have read the briefs, and the challengers to the executive order raise independent obligations, even arising from the Constitution, in their complaint that they contend are the source of law at issue, that the sort of avoid this ripeness question. But, you know, as a practical matter, I have to agree with Gene on this. It's hard to imagine a court going down that route when it could wait and see how the executive order is applied and look at a narrower set of facts in determining not its legality in and of itself, but the legality of an agency's action in implementing it. And I think also, you know, this point about the difficulties for deregulatory actions is a great one. You're absolutely right, Gene, about this concern that we saw from the Labor Department. I think that's also the same kind of concern that's animating questions around the social cost of carbon and how agencies can take deregulatory actions, given that in the past they've accounted for things in a certain way. So I think there is a lot to be watching, although right now in the courts, not as much.
I'll make another call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter
star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Monday, August 14th at 12 noon. That call will be a discussion of the third-party doctrine and Carpenter v. United States and will feature Jim Harper, Vice President at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and Orrin S. Kerr, Fred C. Stevenson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any more questions, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
None here other than, Emily, thank you. I thought that was, at least from my perspective, an engaging discussion.
Oh, likewise. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I enjoy hearing the financial perspective, particularly because I tend to focus on energy and environment. So it's always nice to have a bit of cross-pollination in that regard, too. And Lauren, thank you very much for moderating the discussion.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.